Welcome to our fourth and final segment of this afternoon's program. It's Sunday, the 30th of January, 2022. It is now 2:28 in the studio, and I'm your host, Kieran Murdoch. Good afternoon. On this segment, we want to react to the news. There's a deal with something there, folks. On this segment, we want to react to the news that the woman suspected of being responsible for the homicide of Jane Finch had been found unfit for trial on a related burglary charge due to a reported psychological disorder. Finch was found dead in her Piccadilly home on October 4th last year, shortly after she had called the Dockyard police station and had also posted a desperate plea for help on Facebook, stating that an intruder was in the process of breaking into her home. It is said that when the police arrived on the scene, the attack had already occurred and the suspect was still in the house. It is believed that a knife or another sharp object had been used to inflict fatal wounds on Miss Jane Finch. The young woman was later charged with burglary, but further charges were delayed until a psychiatric evaluation. More recently, it was announced after that evaluation had been done that the 21-year-old young woman appeared before Magistrate Nayo Emmanuel in the All Saints Magistrates Court, where a prosecutor from the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions briefly shared the findings of an initial report. It was said that the psychiatrist recommended that the young suspect should receive 6 months of treatment, after which she would be re-evaluated and the case could potentially proceed. So on this segment, we'll be asking, what does it mean for those who are seeking justice for the killing of Jane Finch, and what does it tell us about mental health in our society? We're joined on this segment, firstly, by Ms. Jonelle Walsh. She is a clinical psychologist and a counselor. We're happy to have her with us. She joins us on Zoom. Good afternoon to you, Ms. Walsh. You'll have to unmute your microphone. How are you doing this afternoon?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I'm well, thanks.
And we have with us as well, also on Zoom, Mr. David Spencer. He is a community activist and also co-host of Movement Radio, which is a weekly program on Observer Radio dedicated to social and political activism on a range of issues. Good afternoon to you, Mr. David Spencer. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Mr. Murdoch. Good afternoon to Ms. Walsh. I'm doing fine and I look forward to our discourse.
Mr. Spencer, I wonder if I could start the batting with you. That's interesting. I use that term because, of course, I think the under 19 men's cricket is currently underway. But anyway, I want to get a sense from you. We had seen in the aftermath of Miss Finch's killing a very strong call for justice, and we had seen a lot of pressure being exerted on social media and in the press by persons who were anxious to see progress in terms of the police handling of the matter, in terms of dealing with the suspect, bringing charges and seeing that justice was met. Of course, there are many instances where crimes are committed and then it happens to be that the individuals who are suspected are deemed unfit for reason of some manner of psychological disorder. We are told initially that that may be the case in this instance, and that the suspect in question has been recommended for treatment. Where do you think that puts the individuals who are grieving and were seeking justice for the killing of Miss Finch?
Okay, Mr. Murdoch, thank you once again. I must start by saying that when I played cricket for my village side of Sweet, I was the opening batsman. So this is quite up my street in terms of, you know, the cricket analogy. And yes, Kieran, it is a very delicate situation when in the circumstance when a crime is committed, when someone has died and the perpetrator is regarded as somebody with a mental problem and hence diminished responsibility for the crime. That is that the person's mental state might have put the person in such a position that the person will not be held culpable by the law for the act that the person would have committed. And I know that the normal human tendency is to want to see justice, and sometimes you wonder if it's not vengeance, to be done and for that person to face the full penalty of the law. But in a circumstance like that, the law specifies that if the person is held to be insane or suffers from some diminished mental responsibility, then that person cannot be held liable for that act. And hence, it would then perhaps defeat or challenge the family of the person who would have died to look at the situation as well from that perspective, from not just the perspective of wanting the eye for the, an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but also to look at the issue of justice and also to widen that perspective, to see all sides of the case and to understand that the perpetrator will end up spending his or her life in a psychiatric facility. And that, in a sense, would be the kind of justice that would be done, and perhaps would want to extend, those persons would want to extend the call for justice to a better societal approach to the treatment of persons with mental illnesses, all right? And as well, justice would demand that the police are better resourced and can act more promptly to avert, as we're talking about this specific issue, to avert the circumstances that might have led to Jane Finch's death. All right, but we all challenge on both sides, both the family of the person who would have died, as well as the family of the person who would have committed the act and so declared to be not capable of being brought in that sense to justice. That on both sides, families are affected, and there is much pain and much sorting to be done.
Ms. Jonelle Walsh, curious for your take on that same issue, the issue of the sort of effect it might have, particularly on persons who were in a process of loss and grief, and sort of holding on to the idea that they will see stern justice meted out for what was truly a tragedy, but of course, as was discussed by Mr. Spencer, in instances where you do have persons who, there was diminished capacity by reason of a mental disorder or something of that nature, you are not going to see the sort of judicial response that you may have wanted, and many would argue that rightfully that sort of response is not warranted. But what do you think, Ms. Jonelle Walsh?
Good afternoon again to the listening audience. A lot of the times we look at using the justice system, and this is from the family's perspective, who would have been the victim, is that the justice would act as a sense of closure. But in the psychology world, I think for me as well, I don't believe in closure. And as a result, because it's a case where you have to continuously mourn that person, and you would have to mourn the person in order to accept what is happening. So the true justice, as I would say, would come from the family accepting that that they have lost their family member and would have processed all of the emotions that would have come with the loss. Now, on the flip side, we can only imagine what the family members of that person who would have been the perpetrator is going through at that moment. And in this particular moment, as a matter of fact, it must be really difficult. It is unfortunate, though, that in our society, we still don't understand what is mental health and how to deal with mental health. And so, because we don't fully understand and we haven't fully embraced it, it means that we cannot necessarily get to a place where we can begin to talk about justice for somebody who has a mental illness. And because of that, it makes it even more difficult for us as a society to process the loss of someone because of an act, a crime committed by someone who has a mental disability.
Coming back to you, Mr. David Spencer, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we did have an instance recently where there was a gentleman, one of the homicides for last year, I think the one that took place in the St. John's police station. If you recall, Mr. Spencer, the individual,
yes,
the individual who they said was the perpetrator, I believe, or the alleged, the suspected perpetrator, mm-hmm. was also someone who was known to have suffered from mental illness. Is that correct? I can't remember his name at this point in time, which is why I'm sort of shaky on it. But that's correct, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yes, that's correct.
I wanted to use that as an example to ask you the question of. We often have persons who are suffering from mental illness and do require treatment, not getting treatment, and that many times can result in problems. We have seen many instances in Antigua and Barbuda where persons who certainly have been recognized as having some manner of mental illness or challenge, not having the treatment they need, sort of free and interacting as normal, and then they may do somebody harm because their particular illness was one that inclined them to do somebody harm. How do we take an approach that reduces the instances of this sort of thing happening?
Okay, Kieran, Ms. Walsh has already alluded to the fact that we seem not to be able to wrap our heads around the concept of mental illness and as a society to take that on board and look at how we can minimize mental illness, how we can identify and analyze mental illness, and how we can treat mental illness. All right. Historically, we have had a two-tier approach of incarceration. Well, hospitalization, so to speak, of some people who have maybe acute mental illness, and in a way allowing those who are deemed on the surface to not constitute a danger to society and themselves to, in a sense, roam free to be, you know, to be out there in the community, sometimes on their own, sometimes as part of families, but we have not, and I don't know if we have the capacity to institutionalize the many persons who would have clearly demonstrated cases of suffering with mental illnesses. I am not certain that situation can continue to exist, but in the specific case that you cited, clearly, how do you know, this is a critical issue. How do you assess and identify when someone would be so far gone that person would constitute a danger to himself and to someone else? How would the police in this instance, and would they have known, should they have known that one of those two inmates that they put together in a cell had such a mental illness that he would be a danger to the other one? And if they had any inkling, should they not have had some inkling? Should they not have separated them? And do we then have the facility, you know, because it also raises the issue of resources. Do we have the resources to adequately isolate and treat those many persons that need that kind of treatment? So it raises a lot of questions in my head. I am still struggling with how do we really, as I said earlier, how do we identify those many persons who would demonstrate, you know, some level of mental illness, and how do we assess them? How do we even begin to get families? Because I think it would start in families where they would begin to identify behaviors that are out of the norm. And how do you then begin to identify them and seek the necessary treatment? Do we have enough? So our society, I don't think, has reached a stage where we treat mental illnesses with the recognition and the seriousness that it needs to be treated.
Ms. Jonelle Walsh, if I could bring you in, and feel free to respond to anything that's been said, but Mr. Spencer mentioned the issue of facilities and resources. For instance, you could look at the Clearview Psychiatric Hospital here in Antigua and Barbuda. That is an institution which, on and off, faces criticism for the level of resources that are pumped into it and what its capacity is to treat persons who need to be treated. Of course, then there's the issue of actually having a facility where persons who are considered a danger to either themselves or others can actually remain, as opposed to simply a facility where persons come for treatment, but a facility where you are sort of restraining persons because you consider them to be, due to any sort of mental disorder, a threat to others. And then, of course, for persons who do receive treatment, and who may be considered a threat to others, but they have received treatment and are, you know, back out in society and so on. Follow up in terms of making sure that if it is that they're, you know, on a regimen of treatment, medication or something, that, you know, they're sticking to it, and reevaluations to continue to examine their progress. Oftentimes, you know, the resources are sort of spread thin and things fall through the cracks. Do you think, of course, we need to direct more resources to our psychiatric and mental health care facilities, Ms. Walsh?
We definitely do. As Mrs. Spencer would have said, is that mental health is still very much stigmatized. And even if we think about the stigma attached going to Clearview Psychiatric Hospital, it is almost unheard of that you put my family member at the psychiatric hospital. They don't want their family member to go there because of the stigma attached to getting treatment. So it means then that we have to recognize that mental illness is real, that we have to take care of our and the reality of it all is that we have to understand that there are different types of mental illnesses. And so not because you are diagnosed, let's say, with schizophrenia necessarily mean that you're going to be combative. And so we have to begin as a society to understand the different types of mental illness so that we can recognize it in our family members. And that's where it starts, because the people that would probably know are your friends and family to help to recognize that something isn't quite right. So we only recognize mental health and somebody has a mental health problem if the person takes off their clothes and start walking on the street naked. And that really isn't so. The problem would have started long before the person would have gotten to that stage. So we have to begin to acknowledge that there is a need for treatment. And just like you have a cut or you have a broken bone and you go to the Mount St. John's Medical Center for treatment, it is okay to go to the Clearview Psychiatric Hospital for treatment for mental health. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be an inpatient at the psychiatric hospital, because just as you're discharged from the Mount St. John's the same night, that there are treatments that allow for persons to be discharged the very same day as well and have outpatient care at the hospital. So it means that we need to begin to understand the mental health in a broad spectrum before we can begin to say, you know, my family member doesn't need treatment. And it's something that we tend to sweep under the rug once we cannot see it. Mental health has no face. We cannot see it, we cannot touch it, but we can definitely feel it. And the only way we know is if that person describes it to you. And a lot of times we tend to say, well, you have to be stressed over life good, you know? And that necessarily isn't the case, because we don't know what each other is going through. So we have to be very mindful of that and very wary that acknowledge when somebody is not doing well and say to them, there is treatment and there's treatment available. But we definitely can do more as a society to help that treatment process along.
Mr. David Spencer, of course, it was just mentioned by Ms. Jonelle Walsh there that often we don't seek out help or seek out treatment for a friend or family member unless we we really see it manifesting in a very troubling way. There are signs and other things which we may sweep under the rug. It's only until, as she said, somebody does something utterly extreme that we then say, okay, well, you know, certainly this is a problem. But why is that? Why do we tend not to? I mean, sometimes we pick up on these things, but other times, you know, there may even just be you know, an unwillingness to sort of engage with it. What do you think, Mr. Spencer?
I think there is, you know, as Ms. Walsh has said, there is this stigma that is associated with mental health, or, you know, suggesting that somebody is crazy, you know, and we have put a lot of people under the blanket of being crazy. And just to have that stigma maybe attached to a member of your family, or to admit that somebody is not coping or somebody is not behaving as he or she normally does and should do, or he or she seems to have a problem, taking on a problem, just to accept the fact that you are stressed more than usual and it's getting to you and you're not coping with whatever life situation you're dealing with, just to arrive at that point is a really big step. And so for the person to self-acknowledge that is a big step. And I don't think our society has, as Ms. Walsh has said, just to accept that I might be just in need of that kind of mental self-care. I mean, I can, there's a facility that exists, or the treatment, the whole regime of treatment, assessment, is in place, and it is acceptable. It becomes a norm within the society that the psychological and psychiatric care of people is as important, that health is as important, and perhaps maybe even more important than the physical regime, the physical facilities and resources that are put in place for treatment of physical and biological types of illness. So we have still have a long way to go, Kieran, in that regard. And because of the stigma that's attached to it, because of the unwillingness on the part of people as well, the individuals who might be affected, to accept that I am not doing well, I'm not coping well with a particular situation. And because it's not yet in place for us to be able to do that assessment as a society and as the individuals, I think those are some of the issues which will contribute to us still at this stage where people are unwilling to come forward, or relatives are unwilling to bring their sister, their brother, their mother, their father forward to get the kind of care that they need.
Ms. Jonelle Walsh, I mean, I've heard persons say that, you know, they've had family members who they've had treatment for a mental disorder or psychological disorder, and because of their reaction to that treatment, let's say they put on a regimen of drugs that had certain other effects on them, it any range of effects that were simply unpleasant, that the person became unwilling to continue with treatment. And of course, family members and friends being sympathetic to that situation sort of fall in line with them not being willing to continue their treatment. That's an issue I have heard before. How do we address things like that? The fact that when somebody may go for treatment, treatment may include a number of other effects and a change in their temperament, which they may not prefer. Of course, then that will incline them to not want to continue with treatment, and it may incline their family to not want to press them to continue with treatment. But the alternative is that sometimes without treatment, they can be a danger to themselves and others. Well, what do you think?
So one thing we have to know is that medicine is evolving. And because medicine is evolving, it would be important for that particular family member to have a conversation with their doctor. Have the conversation about the different types of treatment, understand what the side effects are of the medication that that person is being put on, and see what treatment option is best for you. A lot of the times, medication can go hand in hand with talk therapy. So some mental illnesses can be treated through talk therapy. There isn't medication only. Some need a combination, and some you definitely have to have medication, or else that person is no good for any of us, really and truly. So it means that that conversation, the family member and that person cannot just say, "I'm going to take myself off of medication," because you're not the doctor. The doctor give you the advice, and it is up to you to follow that advice, really and truly. Yes, but it is important for you to get the help that you need so that you can function. And in order to get that help, it means that you have to have that important conversation to see what is your best treatment option.
Coming back to you, Mr. David Spencer, I'll give you an opportunity to give us a final word. It was a brief discussion this afternoon, but what would you leave us with, especially as we look back to the issue that we started out on, which was more particularly, instances where you do have someone who has been alleged to have committed a very serious crime, caused a serious tragedy, but it's been determined that that person may have had diminished capacity to really be in control or understand the severity of what they were doing, and where that leaves all of us as a society.
Okay. So I'm left thinking that and wondering if a more timely intervention, timely response on the part of the police might not have resulted in a different outcome. It was said that Miss Finch had been in conversation with the police, and one wondered what kind of advice that they might have given her in terms of barricading, whether she was advised to barricade herself in her bedroom, and if they would have given her the assurance that they would have been at her house within the next 10, 15 minutes. So that outcome could have been different. Her life could have been saved, despite the fact that the intruder would have been in her house. All parties should have been concerned about the extent to which they could save her life. So, I mean, and not only in that instance, but in terms of intervention in situation of mental illnesses, the issue of timely intervention is critical. The importance of having resources available that will support that kind of intervention. And in the case of the search for justice, the importance of having for the family, for the Finch's family, of ensuring that the process, because I understand they've been concerned about the delay in the process, that there needs to be that acceptance that nothing will bring back their loved one, but that justice is also about a process that is transparent, fair, and timely, and that this process also has to be so for the victim as well as for the person who would have committed the act.
Ms. Jonelle Walsh, what would you leave us with to end off this discussion?
It is definitely an unfortunate situation that would have occurred, but what it tells me as a society is that we're nowhere near ready to handle cases of mental illness because we tend to be very reactive rather than proactive. And so we need to get ahead of the ball game. First of all, we need qualified professionals, more qualified professionals. We need better facilities. Better intervention strategies so that we could definitely try to avoid as much as possible situations such as these. It means that even the very people who are employed in the society, such as the police officers, need formal training in mental illness and not just one course. Because the thing is, mental illness is very dynamic. It varies from person to person. And so you definitely have to understand what it takes and how to treat that person. And so it means that those persons in society need more than just one course in it. And so we have a long way to go. And this situation shouldn't be a case where we're reacting to it, but we should have already had things in place to help in these situations because both families, believe it or not, are the two end of the spectrum. They're suffering, even though they're at two different end of the spectrum. Because what we don't know is if the alleged perpetrator family reached out for help for this person before, and what sorts of help had she gotten before? Was there any intervention? Did anybody know where to guide the family members? And if that isn't the case, then we do have a serious problem, and we definitely need to do more in terms of advocating and educating persons about mental illness in Antigua and Barbuda.
With that, I think we can end this discussion here. I want to say thank you to Ms. Jonelle Walsh, the last voice you would have heard speaking there, folks. She is a clinical psychologist and a counselor. And we were joined as well by Mr. David Spencer, community activist and also co-host of Movement Radio, a weekly program here on Observer. Thanks to both of you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.